Question of the day, IFRS implementation. Carolyn Clark unfortunately couldn't make it, but Sharon Williams, I understand, is here. Sharon, at the back there. So, welcome to Sharon.
Hello, everybody. I am not very familiar with speaking on a microphone, so I will just put that caveat up front. I'll also say that I probably know that this is not the most exciting topic of the day by far. It's probably a topic you've all been hearing about for way too many years, and is we're getting towards what I hope is the end of its tediousness, and hopefully it's just going to become business as usual, and we can move on to more interesting things, such as Christoph presented now. But now that we are just short of 5 months into our first year of reporting under IFRS 17, I wanted to recap a bit about the basics, or what it means for a medical scheme. Some of this might be very familiar to some of you, but just baselining a bit. And then also looking at it specifically now that we've got through these almost 5 months, what are the key reflections that we've picked up in and from both an implementation and an audit perspective. So a bit of a potentially familiar slide, but IFRS 17 replaced IFRS 4. It was always going to be. And I think the biggest question in the case of a medical scheme was whether or not IFRS 17 was going to be mandated as the basis of accounting, basis of reporting. There was a bit of discussion on that, and ultimately, I suppose CMS, as the regulator, decided to adopt IFRS 17, or that medical scheme should adopt it. The pieces surrounding classification disclosure were somewhat covered by IFRS 4, but the biggest changes really came in terms of the presentation and the measurement. And that is where we've seen the biggest impact on the medical scheme's reporting. I suppose it's no surprise. A lot of this then really came from actually looking at a lot of strain in this came from looking at what happened over those 2 years of the transition, the last 2 years. There's been a bit of uncertainty, I think a bit of a hesitancy to act and adopt the standard outright, to really start doing transition work and calculations, largely based on, I think, awaiting for a standardized guidance on what it should look like and what should be the case for medical schemes. The biggest driver here is probably, if we look at the mutual discussion, whether the reporting and so IFRS accounting of medical schemes should adopt a mutual classification. And that discussion went late into 2023. There were notably changes then on what that meant from an IFRS 17 implementation perspective. But if we now look at the specific piece on the mutual and accounting for mutuals, it talks about the fulfillment cash flows due to groups, and more importantly for a medical scheme, future policyholders. So effectively, we talk about our accumulated funds and reserves now being part of our liability, not being shown separately as equity, because fundamentally that is what is going to fund our future members, fund their liabilities, and so can be taken into account when assessing the fulfillment cash flows under IFRS 17. The basis of conclusion of IFRS 17 also discusses the implication of this in the context of a mutual, and in particular the need to not recognize a comprehensive income for a reporting period. This meant, and now please forgive me, I've spent way too much time being an accountant, not an accountant, but talking accounting. So, and IFRS 17 makes me do it. If we look at the change in the income statement, not a very actuarial place at all. But there are a few key points that come into being. So apart from the needing to get to a zero at the end and the movements in the names of the various line items, there are a few places where actuarial involvement came into this. Potential discussions on items such as insurance revenue now needing to bring forward that potential for default or non-collection of contributions, although in most cases that's argued to not be a significant number or impact. Additionally, there's the point on insurance service expense, where now we need to reclassify where certain aspects of our income statement are sitting, moving certain expenses and anything really fundamentally related to the member contract into that line item. Additionally, I think what's important to note is that if we move to the balance sheet, there's some shifts in terms of not only the presentation of removing the need for funds or the presentation of the funds, but also the moving of balances between line items, particularly, and again, sounding more accounting-like, the trade payables and receivables now needed to be stripped out of any components that may be insurance or contract-related. Of an area that we picked up of particular confusion and uncertainty was around the risk transfer arrangements. So here, while not reinsurance in the traditional sense, they'd met the IFRS 17 classification and so needed to be measured as such in many cases. And this now meant that there is a separate line item on this balance sheet that now talks to the value of these, where previously it was included in trade and other receivables, if at all. If we then also look at these with the context of these changes in presentation in mind, if we look through some of the principles of IFRS 17 and how they impacted the medical schemes, I think that does show quite a bit why it was a lot more complex for medical schemes to adopt this than I would have expected. For context, I am actually primarily work in the non-life industry with a chunk of life insurance experience and some international experience with healthcare or health insurance, which doesn't actually have as much in common with the South African market as you might expect. And coming from that background into looking at IFRS 17 with the South African medical scheme context, was quite surprised at how much of a challenge it appeared for the medical schemes to adopt it. And some of the reasons why it was a challenge talk to the need to change how certain contracts are recognized and seen. The medical savings account being a prime example, which was previously unbundled and shown separately and completely accounted for separately, while still meeting the requirements of having to not flow through your risk income and your contribution income and your benefits paid from an income statement perspective, did now need to be reclassified and joined in with the rest of the insurance contract liability. This led to a number of complexities in terms of when we actually go through measurement and how that flows into the financial statements of where the various components and ins and outs, so to speak, of these PMSAs went through. Then maybe the more actuarial principles to touch on are these two primary examples of why something that should have, or why IFRS 17 should have been comparatively simple for medical schemes. The first, looking at the actual measurement model, being with all contracts being less than 12 months and all claims pay off in less than 12 months, we also expected a lot more simplicity in the measurement, a lot less necessary for involvement of actuaries in the measurement. Taking it a step further, the conclusion of the mutual discussion with most schemes electing to take on the mutual measurement for the purpose of accounting meant that the question in terms of whether a loss component should be raised, whether there were onerous contracts based on schemes pricing in a deficit, largely fell away and was instead replaced by a view that the current, non-current split, should a scheme choose to take that, would purely show the portion of the liability due to future members in its current split. In a bit where the actuarial involvement really came into the forefront fundamentally was then limited to three pieces. The first is on the best estimate liability. So from a reserving standpoint, this is where actuarial involvement was primary forefront in the financial statements historically. The biggest change being that from a historical perspective, it was standard practice and accepted practice for schemes to use data post the measurement date in their projections. So why in most other or for most other areas on the insurance industry, valuation date data could only be used in the setting of these estimates. The actual runoff of claims experience up to April and the final CMS submission would effectively be used to update those IBNR estimates until the final financials were signed. IFRS 17 is quite prescriptive in prohibiting this, and so there was a need to go and re-estimate and adjust the actuarial liabilities so that only the data as at 31 December was used for each of the valuation periods. What this does, if we reflect on it, and what this means going forward, is that there's a chance for more volatility and more movement in our claims provision, something that's not been, there's a lot of focus on the movement on the IBNR from a regulatory perspective and it needing to be within 10%. And now, because of having to estimate this liability as at 31 December without using actual runoff, there is potential for that over and under to come through. And from an IFRS 17 perspective, this is expected because we have a best estimate liability and our best estimates should have an equal likelihood of being under and overstated year on year. I think we should all be comfortable with that principle. But the natural inclination to potentially be a bit more conservative is now going to be highlighted. And in particular, I'll refer to it in a few slides, but the disclosure of a past service movement is actually putting it directly in the financial statements how wrong your reserve was last year. So it really does create a bit of a window for scrutiny. I saw a few heads up at that. But yes, the other point, I suppose, was probably one that was discussed and debated at length in many cases, and that is the risk adjustment, which in the case of a medical scheme, we say, okay, short runoff, limited volatility, stable claims should be small. Most cases is a relatively small number, but not in all. And I think the movement of only looking at the reserve as at 31 December, not allowing for that post-valuation date experience, does mean that there is a bit more volatility that the risk adjustment is being based off. Fundamentally, that is what it's there for. It's supposed to capture the potential for that adverse development at the selected confidence interval. What we saw in terms of confidence intervals was actually quite a range across the industry, with some medical schemes motivating quite low confidence intervals, just above 50% even in the extreme cases, others motivating very high confidence intervals, as high as 95%. This variability did talk to the different scheme appetites, which is the intention of the standard, and does lead to somewhat different levels of what the actual risk adjustment was. In terms of methodology, a direct confidence interval bootstrapping type approach was probably one of the most commonly used, although we did see some variability across the industry. Some thoughts on terms of what a risk-based solvency type metric could be, as well as other metrics using runoff data, bit more unusual or slightly different approaches, but still meeting the requirements and capturing what the risk adjustment is fundamentally there for. The final point on this slide may be worth noting is attributable expenses. In one of its circulars, CMS did provide an indicative mapping of what it would consider to be an attributable expense in the context of a medical scheme, particularly an administered medical scheme. There is a bit of variability on what we would expect to be allocated for an administered versus not self-administered scheme, which was then left open to schemes to interpret. However, we did see an inclination to adopt the standard mapping as opposed to consider the specific nature of individual schemes. The piece where this then feeds into the actuarial modeling is theoretically whether there's an allowance for these attributable expenses within the best estimate reserve. So should we allow for expenses that are incurred in the running off of the liability of the existing book? Majority of cases, this wasn't done. In the case of administered schemes, the logic was quite standard that the administrator fee has been paid and there's no future cost incurred. Self-administered schemes, a bit more of a materiality-based argument was put forth, but something to potentially consider as actuaries in the space is whether there is potential need for any sort of expenses to be allowed for in the reserve. Maybe one other point that I didn't actually note when we're talking about the best estimate liability and the nature of the reserve is that given the less actual experience and more reliance on a single point of data being the December claims experience, there was also a bit more consideration of alternate methodologies such as Bornhøgger-Ferguson instead of a basic chain ladder, and I think a few more considerations in terms of what would actually get us to the most reasonable reserve in the case of not being able to use the data post-valuation date. Moving on to a few other principles that IFRS 17 introduces. Mostly what is on this side, I think the biggest of the slide, the biggest focus was on grouping, but this is a topic that I think would have been discussed quite a bit even not just a year ago, but even 2 years ago where the discussion first came up, looking at the definition of the overall scheme as a portfolio. I think this does talk very much to how medical schemes are priced, what the principles, I think Christoph talked to a lot of them in the previous session, that we look at in terms of self-sustaining and overall having schemes that are functional at that level. And then I think in terms of the separate presentation, there are some nuances of this, which I did touch on briefly, but what we haven't looked at in too much detail is the actual additional disclosure requirements. So I've just got an abbreviated view of the disclosure note here, the paragraph 100, in the case of an insurance contract, the same is required or consistent additional separate note is required for the reinsurance contracts or RTAs. But I think what I wanted to touch on quickly here is an area which does have a bit more of an actuarial focus as opposed to all the accounting cash flow mappings. And that is the past service split that I mentioned. So this is one of the areas where we definitely noted that schemes battled and took very inconsistent approaches. And fundamentally, what this is trying to show us is, of my opening bell, how wrong was my opening bell? So the incurred claims line would reflect everything new that has been introduced over the year, everything new that was incurred, new IBNR, but then the past service adjustment is the difference between what you raised as the reserve at the opening for the prior years and what is the fundamental and actual versus expected on what's come through. So while probably not getting as much focus as yet, given all the other strain of actual adoption of IFRS 17, one of the areas I think that we can look for a bit more focus on and a bit more interest in coming years is how much we do weight and relevance we do put on that line, given it's now showing directly to users of the financials an actual versus expected on the prior year reserving. Maybe to make it a bit more real, the opening or transition balance, the 1 January 2022 balance, would have been done while we still had a lot of uncertainty because of the COVID claims, not knowing how that would play out. So looking at only data available at 31 December 2021, there tends to be a slightly higher reserving estimate that was raised. If you then look at the actual claims that incurred over 2022 in respect of that prior year, tends to be a bit lower, and that means that your past service adjustment in many cases is a release in reserves. the comparative view of the, or the actual view shown in the 2023 financials for the 2023 year, it tends to be a smaller change because at 31 December 2022, we had a bit more certainty in the industry that, and life was returning to a bit of a normal. And you can actually see that come through within the collectively across the industry. So things like that can be explained, but what else would we see in future years when we look at this and try and provide that context on what we have had versus what's actually or expected versus what's actually come through. So yeah, some points, I maybe talked a bit fast on some of them, maybe skipped some things, but I'm sure none of you will mind getting some time back to the day. But maybe some key takeaways. So now that we're here, IFRS 17's live, I think most financial statements have been audited at this stage. I think the biggest shift relates to presentation and the changes from accumulated funds to the liability for future members due to that mutual accounting. There are some minor changes to measurement, including the valuation date information, but fundamentally, it's a best estimate reserve, and that is what has been raised going back many years. The risk adjustment also, as I mentioned, tends not to be the biggest number, although it does need to be included. Thinking about how the industry adopted IFRS 17, the general sense is that there's a lot of hesitancy and reliance on industry guidance. Schemes, for the most part, didn't want to be the first to act, didn't want to take a view that might, in some point, be in contravention or in some way different to what the rest of the industry or the regulator might take. And that definitely slowed progress. Also, thinking about the nature of the very different systems and quality of data of the various schemes was also definitely a driver in how the ease with which they were able to adopt it, despite the relative simplicity of the standard in the case of a medical scheme. So interested to see whether this spars any further thoughts on changing processes to allow for the more simple financial statement preparation as opposed to a more manual process we've seen in many cases. And I think the question may be worth asking and reflecting on, and it's probably been asked many times up until now, is has IFRS 17 added value for medical schemes? Probably slightly controversial question, and at this point it's all hypothetical because it's here and it's done. Given the points I made about the minor changes, potentially not as much value as in the case of an insurer, but there are points to look for. The additional disclosure and consistency of disclosure could provide better benchmarks and more information for other exercises to be explored and potentially to flow into other processes and maybe be used for the benefit of the overall industry. But in and of itself, minimal changes overall after all that work. That's me.
Hi. I'm not going to answer or talk to that last point, but I want to go back to the risk adjustments, and I just want to understand, you said that generally you've seen a bootstrap being used. When you say that, do you mean a MAC or an ODP used in conjunction with a bootstrap with replacement, or do you mean a pure MAC or ODP without the statistical components?
Tends to be with the statistical components, so with the replacement, with the sampling and full.
Okay, thank method. You.
But maybe just to clarify, there have been vast varieties of the approach. So you can see difference in maturity and difference in data volumes and amounts of effort deemed necessary to quantify comes through.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and definitely much more interesting than the other talks of the day.
So much more interesting.
Look, I'll wager an opinion on your last bullet, and I will begin to see how the AGMs this year play out. You know, so Sean Osner liked to joke about the fact that the Council of Medical Schemes appear to believe that they are the users of audited financial statements, but I still, old school, I believe the members of a medical scheme are the users of audited financial statements. And, you know, through no fault of our own or I think the intentions of IFRS, I do think the both the balance sheets and the income statements have become more confusing for an ordinary member to interpret. And it's, you know, I think we should own up to it. It's not our fault. I think it's part of a bigger system that we all play a part in. But income statements that show zero result is confusing. You know, liability for future members is like, what is it? You can see, and I anticipate some questions at AGMs. And it's also evident that most medical schemes are kind of supplementing their own audited financials with long supplementary notes to try and appease. So that's my comment. I think, has it added value? I think, unfortunately, not. I think if in the hands of the member, it's probably made things a little bit worse, and I think it is just what it is. I think we need to deal with it. My question really is just, I'm not sure to what degree council has started weighing in on these, or, you know, ultimately the financial statements still need to go to council, must be adopted and approved by them. And I'm not sure if you have any early warning signs or early indicators as to whether kind of council is on board with, you know, the main points of being a mutual and the consequences and the way these things are being presented? Or do you think there's a risk that we'll still see some kind of pushback later this year from council, or would you rather prefer not to say?
So I haven't got anything specific to feedback on as yet that we've got. I do know that council was involved to some extent in the initial discussions, and I'd hope that they aren't going to change their view, having seen what it actually means when that's the impact of that point is put through in a financial statement, but there's no way to say for sure.
Hello, Chris Hoffman from MedScheme. I've got a question more for the healthcare committee. Alex, I don't know if you would like to answer this now or at another stage, but given that this was quite a significant change in terms of reporting, and she highlighted the inconsistent approaches to the different aspects where actuarial involvement was required, was it intentional from the healthcare committee not to publish an advisory practice note or something like that, just to give guidance? Or yeah, just wondering about that. Thank you.
Thanks. No, certainly it was a standing agenda on our meetings for, I don't know, over a year. so there was consistent feedback, updates, etc. I don't think it was ever proposed that we do something like that, so we probably just didn't think about that. But we certainly did have some sessions on IFRS in the past. So, but I think it just wasn't thought of. I don't know if anybody else can remember in the healthcare committee, but yeah, we definitely said we should put it in the seminars, and certainly the healthcare committee members discussed it at meetings. So that's the extent of how far we went. Yeah.
Thanks. Did I hear you correct that the confidence interval ranged from 50% to something like 99.5? Does that actually reflect the risks between the medical schemes, or was it a case of not standard and people doing their own thing? And is there any further comments you can make on the confidence intervals?
So no one was quite as low as 50%, because then there's no risk adjustment effectively, but there were arguments. I think the lowest I saw was 60%. And I think fundamentally, also bringing in insurance experience and the wider insurance adoption, which where IFRS 17, I suppose, has had a much more noticeable impact, the confidence intervals there have also ranged significantly. Talking to the requirements of the standard, it should reference the risk appetite. And I think that's where it's very subjective in the case of any company, but particularly a medical scheme, because what is the risk appetite of a medical scheme? How risk averse are you versus not? And so it can be very wide. I think in certain cases there was a bit of analysis of some historical reserve sufficiency to inform the level that it was set at. But yeah, in many cases it was effectively a decision adopted by the scheme, I think, with in varying levels of information informing the decision. The challenge most schemes will have now is that it's fundamentally part of accounting policy, and in subsequent years, if they actually decide, oh no, 99% was too conservative, we want to adjust it to 75%, that audit hurdle would be to explain why the risk appetite has changed. And that's probably going to be an interesting discussion and may depend and vary from scheme to scheme, auditor from auditor. I hope I answered the question.
Yes, you did. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Any last question? No? Cool, thanks very much, Sharon. Thanks for stepping in.